Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guest is Susie Stonefield, an artist, creativity coach, song leader, and mom.
Susie is a late blooming queer cis woman, coming out only 4 years ago at the age of 56. She's passionate about her work, which is guiding people on the path to healing through intuitive and process-oriented art making and self-expression. And she's passionate about being mom to three amazing young adults. Today, Susie is living her life as her fullest, most authentic self, and happy to report she's madly in love. Welcome, Susie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We are really looking forward to speaking with you in more detail and learning about your life, Susie. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
I'd love to change the world.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of April 2nd, 2023. Last week, Uganda's parliament passed what's being called one of the most extreme anti-LGBTQ+ bills in the world. If signed into law by President Yoweri Museveni, the legislation would impose a life sentence for, quote, recruitment, promotion, and funding, end quote, of same-sex activities, and would make some forms of, quote, aggravated homosexuality punishable by death. As U.S. officials, including U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield and Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Council spokesman John Kirby condemned the bill, others have pointed to the role of American anti-LGBTQ+ religious groups in setting the stage for the legislation. According to foreign affairs columnist for the Washington Post, Ishan Tharoor, a state of paralyzing activist U.S. religious groups have for years campaigned in parts of Africa, especially in countries like Uganda, and sown the seeds for even more hardline measures there. Tharoor notes that London-based Open Democracy found that close to half of the $54 million spent between 2007 and 2020 by American religious organizations advocating against anti-LGBTQ+ rights in Africa was spent in Uganda alone. They used the money to advocate for conversion therapy and convince people that people can successfully become ex-gay. Homosexual sex is already punishable by life imprisonment in the East African nation under its colonial-era penal code, but anti-LGBTQ+ sentiment has been on the rise in Uganda, fueled in part by evangelicals outraged over the Anglican Church's recent decision to bless same-sex unions. The new bill is a revived version of the anti-LGBTQ+ legislation that was nullified by Uganda's Constitutional Court in 2014 on procedural grounds. And here in the U.S., Idaho Governor Brad Little signed a bill last week that bans transgender students from using restrooms and locker rooms associated with their gender identities and requires them to use facilities that align with their sex assigned at birth. The bill says that transgender students who are, quote, unwilling or unable, end quote, to use the wrong bathroom can request a reasonable accommodation in writing. Some of those accommodations, like single-person makeshift restrooms, have already been found to violate transgender students' rights by federal courts. The bill also allows cisgender students to sue school districts if they, quote, encounter a person of the opposite sex while accessing a public restroom, changing facility, or sleeping quarters designated for use by the aggrieved student's sex, end quote. They will be entitled to $5,000 for each instance of sharing a facility with a trans student, as well as attorney's fees and damages for, quote, psychological, emotional, and physical harm suffered, end quote. The states of Arkansas and Iowa passed similar legislation last week as well. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed the bill banning trans youth from using the correct bathrooms, as well as a ban on trans youth accessing gender-affirming care. And in Arkansas, Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders signed a bathroom bill that goes beyond what other states are doing and imposes criminal penalties. Someone who uses a public restroom, not just in schools, associated with their gender identity and not their assigned sex at birth, can be charged with a misdemeanor sexual indecency crime. if they know that a child of the opposite sex was present. And in Texas last week, a West Texas A&M student-led LGBTQ+ organization and its leaders have filed a federal lawsuit after a student drag show was canceled Monday by the university's president, who called such shows, quote, derisive, divisive, and demoralizing misogyny, end quote. His decision is drawing backlash from students and free speech advocates. The lawsuit filed last Friday by the student organization Spectrum WT against University President Walter Wendler and other school leaders alleges that Wendler, quote, is openly defying the Constitution, end quote. In a published edict, President Wendler barred a recognized student group, Spectrum WT, from exercising its clear First Amendment rights to put on a PG-13 clarity drag show at a campus event hall with the aim of raising funds for LGBTQ+ suicide prevention. In response, the president said the drag show discriminates against womanhood and compared them to blackface and said that there was no such thing as a harmless drag show. He said that a harmless drag show is not possible. A bill seeking to regulate public venues hosting drag performances is currently pending in the Texas state legislature. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglia.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Susie Stonefield, artist extraordinaire, creativity coach, song leader, and mom. And we want to thank you so much, Susie, for giving us a little time from your very busy schedule.
Yes.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Well, so are we.
So let's get started so people can understand what is a creativity coach? Tell us about that.
Basically, I am a personal coach for your inner artist. So I help people go into shadowy places and their hearts and pull it out and get it on the page and release it all through creativity. And I work with people one-on-one and in groups. We do work on grief, transitions, relationships, our stories, narratives, all the things you would talk about actually with a therapist are the kinds of things that we talk about. But I'm not a therapist. I'm an expressive arts facilitator and an artist and a teacher. And all of those things braid together for me to create a sacred and safe container for people to look at what's going on under the surface and bring it up into the light so that they can heal and transform.
So are you saying then that your philosophy is once somebody gets their shadow out onto the paper, it goes away?
No, not at all. Our shadow's definitely part of us all the time. It's just that, especially I think in our culture, we're conditioned to avoid looking at it because it's scary and it's dark and everyone wants to focus on happiness and joy and all the good things. But the reality is we're all of it, and you can't have the shadow without the light. And so I sort of see myself as, you know, I'll walk on the dark path with you and hold the flashlight while you look into that sort of scary stuff. And I'll be there right with you and listen and hold the space so it's a bit safer. And then we'll talk about it. So there's just tremendous transformation and healing that happens with that. It's really powerful. And I've done that work for myself. That's why I do it, because I found it for myself and it was so cathartic and healing that I thought other people should know how to do this. So that's when I got deeper into it.
Can you be a little more specific without going too much into your own privacy, but could you give us an example, either with a client or with yourself or somebody, to help us understand how it's so transformational?
For example, not to jump the gun, but when I came out 4 years ago, which I'll be talking about even more soon, I had already been doing this practice. It's using an art journal or a sketchbook, color, images, words, texture, to go into my heart and get it out on the page. And then release it basically to the universe. So when I was coming out, I started a specific art journal to just look at this experience I was having so I could tap into my guilt or my grief or my shame or my fear or my joy and my passion and desire and every page is like a facet of my experience. It's like looking at a photo album of my story, but it's every page's feelings. It's like, rather than looking at, oh, here I was at this place and here I was, it's like, oh, I was feeling this on this day and I was feeling this on this day. And so I have pages and pages, I have books, and I have like 50 art journals now on my shelf of my life, not just my coming out story. I have 7 of my coming out story. But I have all these pages that are all like my self-portrait, aspects of my self-portrait, mostly of my heart, not how I look, but how I felt in all of these moments. And so it's so private, and it's also so satisfying. And I don't know if this is answering your question to give you a really specific example, but you know, I think part of it is that the process is very intuitive. That's how I teach it also. It's to really listen to your heart when you're, and rather than your brain. Your brain wants to make everything make a lot of sense and be very definitive, and your heart has so much to say that is not definitive. It's expressive. It's just a very different part of your expression. Everybody has that in them. And I've really trained myself to pay attention and to believe it and to trust it, I guess I should say. So I follow that. I follow this part of myself when I'm creating a page with paint and images, and I may not know what it's about when I'm working on it until later, or some point later, deeper into the process, when a story will rise up and then I'll spill it onto the page. And it's a very moving experience. People cry a lot when they're making their pages, depending on what they're working on, you know, feeling the grief finally uncork and pour out because of really paying attention to a part of their expression that doesn't have a voice most of the time. It's not something you can tell your therapist necessarily when it's images and color that needs to come out in the process. So it's another kind of healing that can happen.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, Susie. I'm just thinking about myself as a therapist, the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I do a lot of expressive work, but not with art as much,
right?
Especially because I'm on Zoom now. But I love how you're expressing it. You're bringing the light into what is living.
Yes.
But you're bringing it out onto the page so they can see it, in a sense. But it says a lot about you too, Susie, that they trust you enough to grapple with what is coming forth.
Right. You know, it's been a process for me of learning how to hold that space. When I first started teaching art journaling, I had only done it for myself, and I was a teacher. I knew how to create a classroom container, you know, and I was a curriculum developer and I knew how to write curriculum. But the first year that I opened my art studio, which was in Cotati, I did a class called the Body Passion Project. And because I had done my own work on my body image, which was not great, because basically most women in our world don't have great body images from the society we live in and messaging. And my students had said they wanted to do that work when they saw the work I had done. So I started this class, and it was dark. Like the first night, everyone showed up with their stories. I always ask, what brought you here? And the stories of what brought them there were dark, dark stories, because there's so much pain and wounding and abuse and betrayal and abandonment, oh, so much, all wrapped up into our body stories. And I felt the weight of that. I felt the weight of what I had asked these women to do, to come with me on this journey. I felt like I'd said, come down to the River Hades and we'll play in the water together. And then I went home that first night and I was like, oh my God, what have I done? What have I asked them to do? But I have strong intuition about how to hold the space. So I was able to do that during that class. And then I decided I want to stay here in this place with people. Like, this is definitely my life's purpose, is to guide people in such rich territory that we don't have an opportunity to really explore. So I went back to school and got my certificate in expressive arts facilitation, because it was really critical to me to have the integrity when I held that space. And so now I don't hesitate from doing heavy duty work like that. I'm right now in the middle of a 8-week grief program that's so incredibly rich and beautiful what people are able to do. And I thank you for acknowledging that I'm the one creating that space, and I know it's working because they're saying things like, I'm finally crying after all this time of not crying, or I finally feel lighter than I've felt in so long. And the beauty of their exploration is profound. So it's really, my work is so meaningful to me.
Beautiful, beautiful. You work mostly with women?
Yeah, and non-binary people, and I would love to work more with trans folks, and I would love to have some exclusively queer space. At this point, I haven't pulled that together, but yeah, mostly women are the people who show up, and there have been men, mostly when I had my in-person studio. Now, most of my work is online now, and I've moved out of Sonoma County and have a studio in my loft in Alameda County. So I do some in person again, but anyway, it's mostly women who just show up to do this. And I'm not sure why, except that I guess our culture doesn't really encourage men to go to that place very often, which I think makes it more important for me to offer it to them too, you know?
You mentioned, I know you went back to school for creative facilitation, but you say you were a teacher before. You've always been an artist or an art teacher? Or
I was an art major. I've always been an artist since I was tiny. I took art classes, and I went all the way through and studied fine art at UCLA, got my bachelor's in that. And then they didn't really teach me how to make a living, and I didn't want to be a waitress. So I decided to do something practical, and I became an elementary school teacher. And so I taught in Northern California and was an administrator for about 12 years, and also did some reading support and tutoring, things like that. And then I started having kids. And at a certain point, I really didn't want to pay someone else to be with my kids. I wanted to be with my kids. So I stopped working and then moved up to Sonoma County. And shortly after that, started homeschooling my kids. So I actually homeschooled my kids for 13 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And all that was awesome. That was a really wonderful, wonderful time. Loved it. And just really a tangent is that when I was in schools, in the institution of education, I always felt like something was off, out of sync, because I was always upset with like the directives coming down from the state or the district or whatever. They bugged me. And I didn't like what I saw happening. And the reason I started homeschooling was because of one of my oldest son who had ADHD, and it just was hard for him to be appreciated in the school environment and thrive. And Sonoma County has a lot of homeschooling support. So I decided to homeschool him. And once I, then eventually my other two came into it as well. And I finally felt authentic. Like it was like, oh, I was supposed to be sort of a pirate, sort of like not doing it the way everyone else was doing it. Felt so much better. And I actually unschooled my kids rather than homeschooled. So unschooling is really life learning, following their passions, throwing the curriculum right out the window, all the things I knew how to do that everyone then gave me cachet, like, oh, well, you're a teacher. Of course, you can homeschool. I was like, oh, no, that's not how we're doing this. We play games and go on field trips and hang out with our friends. And, you know, and I homeschooled them all the way through high school, basically. And now they're all doing fine. So it was good.
Wow. Off to college, too, right?
Yeah. Three of them went to the JC. One of the three is now at Evergreen University or Evergreen College up in Washington. And the other two are working, and they're all, I think, satisfied with their lives and doing well. And, you know, I hate to say that out loud because you never know. I'm superstitious, but yeah, I'm super proud of them.
Good work, Mom.
Thanks.
Taking it in your own hand, right? That's what they do, right?
did you do a lot of art with them? Or is that a crazy question?
No, it's silly because not as much as you would think. No, they're all very creative, but doing their own thing. You know, my eldest is like super creative. He has a 3D printer. He still loves Lego. He's just like, I mean, he's 29 and he makes chain mail and, you know, all this stuff. And they've all been very involved in the LARP community in Sonoma County. And that's
What is that?
is live action role play. And the program they've been doing is called Fan War, and you can look it up online. It's in Sebastopol and all over the place. Katahdi also. Super wonderful program. It's like D&D live action in a park with foam swords. So they've been making their own weaponry and costumes and all this stuff for years. And it's all really imaginative storytelling. And it's role playing and learning about social interactions. And yeah, they all grew up doing that. It's powerful, really. I think a lot of people have a lot of concern when they see kids running around in a park with foam swords, but frankly, it's some of the best socialization that they had growing up. My youngest is 22 and he works full time at Starbucks and he also does LARP the rest of all his free time and he teaches it now. To, you know, he leads the events.
Wow, that's quite wonderful to see your kids happy
Is.
and an independent and enjoying life. Kudos to you, Mama.
Thank you.
It's a lot of hard work growing up and helping them grow up, and you're with them 24/7.
Yep, I
You don't
was.
get to send them off to school and get a break.
No, I found it much harder to send them to school than it was to stay home with them once. Once we started doing it, I loved it so much.
And they loved it as well.
Yeah, especially the oldest and youngest. I'd say the middle one, it wasn't as good a fit for him sometimes socially. But what happened was our family was really, really strong, and they are still very connected to each other, and they're still very connected to me and their dad, and very tight family bond happened. Was a lot less pressure. You know, I felt like when I sent them to school, I had to be the enforcer of whatever it was the school wanted, which didn't always feel right to me. So when it was our own show, I wasn't having to force them to do things, and there was a lot more organic flow and learning, and it was really awe-inspiring to see how they learned things without me being the teacher of it, you know, like how they learned how to read. My youngest learned how to read homeschooling. The other two had learned in school, but he learned how to read later than what most kids do. But he just learned how to read from playing games and seeing people read and, you know, having lots of books and games with things to read. Apples to apples, honestly, it was like big and Pokemon cards.
Yeah, it sounds like a fairy tale kind of life to me.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet. It was pretty sweet. It was a very good life. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've mentioned your family and you've mentioned your husband or their dad. So tell us a little bit about your coming out process and how your family has been affected by that.
Well, I got married when I was 29 to a man, and it was a really good decision. We had a really great marriage, very well matched, like very comfortable, safe, loving, not a lot of conflict. And when I met Mark, I just knew he was going to be a great dad, and that was what I was looking for at that time. I'd always dated guys. And never thought anything else was right for me. And we started having kids in a couple of years later. And somewhere in there, like 7 years into our marriage, I actually had a crush on a woman who was my boss at a school I was working at, and she was a lesbian. And I did not know what that was about. Like had these thoughts, and I was like, "What's that?" It was actually, I had a lot of shame, even though I did not grow up in a strict religious house, a liberal Jewish household. But for some reason, I don't know if it was because it was outside the box of what I thought was right for me or I was supposed to do or Not exactly sure what it was, but, and also I was in a marriage that was straight. So it just, how could I have these thoughts about somebody? It just felt very uncomfortable. So I sort of just pushed it away after a while. And then I had another crush, and I just would like meet women and have these crushes and like, what's happening? And when my middle son was 8 years old, he had a sudden medical situation. It was a neurological condition that needed surgery. And we started down a road that ended up being 10 years of surgeries and 15 surgeries altogether. It was intense. It was intense to parent him. You know, we had a lot of focus on him and our family, dealing with going in and out of surgeries and keeping everybody happy and healthy. And, you know, I was homeschooling my kids. I wasn't working, and I did meet women. I had friends that I had crushes on and things. And at a certain point, it stopped being friends that I had crushes on. It just was sort of a general feeling of something. I need something else. I need to be with women. I'm not sure what this is about. And I didn't allow myself to look at what other people have done in that situation. You know, there actually are a lot of books about people, you know, switching sides or whatever you want to say about it. Just, I didn't allow myself to look at that because I felt so much that if I gave myself the information, I was giving myself permission, and then I would have to leave my marriage. I just knew I was going to have to do that. And I did not feel like that was a safe thing to look at. So for a long time, I just kept pushing it away and pushing away. And, you know, as I said, part of it was I had a child who really needed, I just had these three children. I had this life, like you said, it sounded like this idyllic life. And it really was. Homeschooling was blissful in so many ways. How, if I took care of this thing in myself, seemed very selfish, first of all, and then what would my life be like? So I had so much fear, so much about what was gonna have to happen. Also, I didn't know how I would support myself. I definitely didn't want to go back into education, and that seemed like the only thing I could really do. And also, my husband, who I really loved, you know, I didn't want to break his heart. Also, everyone adored him and me, but I thought more about how my whole family adored him and his whole family and all of our friends and our synagogue community and like everyone I knew. How could I break his heart? Everyone would reject me, was basically what the bottom line was. That was my fear. Also, I actually had a lot of friends who had pretty shitty husbands. And I had this great guy who was like such a great provider and so nurturing. And it wasn't about him. It just wasn't about him at all, except for the fact that I knew that there was something definitely missing in our marriage. And that was about him. That was about him not getting his needs met either. You know, it wasn't just me in sort of the wrong gendered marriage. And about 12 years ago, I finally told him some of it. I had been holding it for a really long time. And I actually started art journaling about it. The year I started art journaling, I thought it was more about my kid and like the anguish of that. And then a couple pages came out that were about my identity and my guilt and shame. And when I look at those pages, I have so much compassion for myself. Like, I had so much guilt and shame and fear about who I was and what was I doing and what was going to happen if I followed it. But I just couldn't. I just felt like I just couldn't do anything. And when I told him, I think about women, he was like, that's fine. Think about women. He was actually not at all jealous or anything. He was really supportive. And I was like, okay, I'll try that. But then actually I met someone, a friend, who had a former life as a lesbian. And then had ended up marrying a man, and she'd been married to him for a long, long time. Once I heard her story, I felt like, okay, I can tell her what's going on. And she was a wonderful listener and really supportive and said, what are you going to do? And that was 6 years ago. So 2 years before I came out, I said, I don't know. And I thought about it for a week or so, came back to her, and I said, I'm not going to do anything. I can't. I don't want to break his heart. I don't want to blow up my life. I just always called it blowing up my life. And then finally, I did tell him, like, I feel like I'll die if I don't want to die and not have experienced this part of myself that I'm, this longing is so enormous. It was like impossible to not think about. And he actually said, then go explore that. And I thought, you know, that was incredibly generous of him. But I said, I think that you're crazy. That will blow up our marriage. And he said, no, I don't think it will. Our marriage is strong. And I was like, I don't think so. That's not how I have relationships. I'm obviously someone who's very much about emotion and depth. And I couldn't imagine that this was just going to be a sexual exploration. It would, to have a relationship with someone, I needed the emotional depth that I envisioned. So I didn't do anything about it. And then one day I was actually at our synagogue and met someone. Just saw her across the room, like we stared right into each other's souls is how it felt. And I was like, uh-oh, something's happening. And I actually took some time, but I ultimately checked with him not too long after that. I was like, are you still okay with me doing a little exploration about this? And he said, yeah. I said, okay, for the record, I think you're crazy. He said, maybe I am. And so I actually reached out to her and started to talk to her and basically pursued a relationship with her. And what I discovered was that there was a part of me that I had never known at all. I had never given this part of myself any oxygen. And once I did, I just blossomed like crazy. I just like a part of myself just like burst out of me. I was like, holy moly, who is that? Who is this person? I had never been like this, ecstatic, passionate, desiring, wanting to give pleasure and get pleasure. And like this, in contrast, I think the way I had been was very inhibited and sort of shut down and disconnected from my body, because clearly there was something that I did not allow up into the light. There's this quote from Anais Nin, and the day came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. And I had always loved that quote, but it had never made sense to me until that day, like that time. I had tried so, so hard to stay tight in a bud, and I just couldn't do it anymore. So I blew up my life, and I just couldn't not. Basically, I just couldn't stay tight in a bed anymore. And it almost felt like it wasn't a choice. It was just time. I felt like, I call God the universe. So I felt like the universe put this woman in my path so that I would move on with my life now. My youngest was about 18. I was done homeschooling, basically. It was time. And it did blow up our life. I was right. You know, my husband, as much as he wanted it to be a side thing for me, you know, saw very quickly that I changed. And he'd never seen me like that either. Just coming into a part of myself that was the truest part of myself. And it was very scary, very, very scary.
I think this is a really good place to stop and take a breath.
Okay.
Because it is what you've just talked about is so intense and so beautiful and terrifying at the same time. And I know everyone wants to know, well, what happened? What happened? And here you are. So you're still good. You're very good, actually. But I think this would be a good time for a little break. You brought a song, and then we will continue your journey after we listen to the song. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, of course.
All right. So could you let us know what we're going to be listening to? You brought a song for us today.
Yeah, the song is These Are the Days by 10,000 Maniacs, which I was really into in my youth. And I found myself listening to that song like it was my theme song. Once my husband and I had our Jewish divorce ceremony. So once I really sort of made a break between what was before and what was coming next. It was actually about a year after I came out, but up until that point, the music seemed to be more like, oh, grief and letting go. And this song is about how it is to blossom. And these are the days to remember and to dance and have joy. And it just, I still sing it because it just feels so right.
Oh, that's beautiful. Say the name of the song again.
These Are the Days.
All right, everybody. We'll see you on the other side. And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof, and we are here with Susie Stonefield, and she is telling us a fantastic story about her artistry, her teaching, her kids, her coming out, and that's where we left it. Right when we left, we listened to this beautiful song, These Are the Days by 10,000 Maniacs. Thank you for bringing that song, Susie.
So we want to continue the story about your, I don't know, I have issues with the blow up, the family thing, the way you named it and labeled it, but that's yours.
Yeah.
But I probably would come up with another meaning for that in a more positive way, because we do transform. We do change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the light hit us in a certain way, you know, things change in our lives. And so you're better for it. So I know I'm curious to know more about blowing up the family. So if you can continue that, I know the audience members are like on their toes waiting, anticipating what's next. What came next?
So I think what came rather rapidly was once I had started this relationship with my, I call her my catalyst. I think a lot of queer people have a catalyst. It's a common terminology in the late in life queer communities that I'm part of. We talk a lot about who was your catalyst. And that relationship for me was very, very brief, but it was enough for me to understand that I had to keep moving forward. And that was probably the most significant thing for me, was that I never turned back. I never said, oh no, you know, I mean, I had moments of feeling so much fear and grief about what I was doing to the family and about my future and how I was going to manage being an adult all by myself, and hadn't done that in 30 years, you know. But the energy that moved me forward just was very consistent, that yes, the truth was forward and out of the marriage. It was not to stay in the marriage. And we did explore polyamory for a while because we were very, you know, we were very committed to each other. We'd never had a time when we weren't committed to each other. That's why I hadn't done anything on the side or secretly. But I think we both realized, we meaning me and my ex-husband, we both needed to be fulfilled and in the right place. And it wasn't together anymore. So we came out to my mom, his mom, our kids. All of those were different kinds of conversations, and I'm not going to share the details, but I'll say that our moms were really upset, and our kids were, you know, my kids are in their 20s, and this was 4 years ago. in their world, sexuality is extremely fluid. For them, you know, not that any child wants to know anything about their parents' sex life, I'll say that, but sexuality is fluid. So that wasn't a shock or something they'd never heard of at all. They congratulated me on being authentic and finding my truth and all that. What was hard for them, and in some ways is still hard for them, is the divorce that followed. It was actually funny to come out to my community and my friends, because people were totally shocked, including you, Sheridan. I distinctly remember our conversation.
I think I came up to you. You were being very vague or something. And I said, Susie, is there something you need to tell me? Did I do something wrong or something like that, right? Yeah. You got this look in your face.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I better tell her or something. It was like I was reading you correctly. I just thought it had to do with me. I had no idea what it was going to have to do with you.
It was so true. You said, I feel like you're holding something back. And I was sort of avoiding talking to everyone at that time. This was January in 2019. Yeah, I wasn't able to talk about what was happening. And I hadn't been able to talk to anybody about it. Very, very few people. And so as I started to tell people, particularly in our Jewish community that had a lot of queer women in it, they were all absolutely flabbergasted. I'm a very good actress, apparently. And Mark and I had been like the power couple at our synagogue and in everywhere, in our family too. You know, everyone was just dumbfounded when I shared this, because I had kept, this was the biggest secret. And I'm a pretty much an open book kind of person. So it was really a hard thing for me to have such a heavy secret that I was carrying with me for literally, it was 22 years when I went back and looked at it. So it was hard. It was really hard. We started going to couples counseling just to at least figure out how to move through this time. And we also agreed that we would both start dating. He was less into that than I was, but it sort of seemed fair. We should both be able to have freedom that way. And, you know, step by step, I moved out of our bedroom. I set up guest room. I turned it into my room. I did start dating. I had a relationship or two. I feel really bad for those women. Like, I was so not ready to have a relationship, and they took the plunge with me a little bit, and it was hard, but I needed it. I needed to have relationships so that I could understand who I was and to really explore what that felt like. I think if I'd been dating anybody, it would have been hard after being with one person for 30 years, but it was particularly different to suddenly be in a queer world. And I wanted to feel queer. I wanted to feel what it felt like to be with women. And there was still that exhilaration that happened right at the beginning when I met my catalyst. But there was also a lot of like, I don't feel so comfortable. I don't know what to do here. And I don't know what it feels like to date or be in a relationship with someone different. And there was also a lot of pain and sadness back home.
Back home with your family, with your kids and husband?
Yeah. And I was working through all these relationships in my family and with my family of origin, my mom. And just a couple months into all of that, my mother-in-law cut me off completely. And I'd had a really good relationship with her for 30 years. It was incredibly sad that she cut me off. And that is the kind of thing, you know, that you fear when you're coming out, is that people will reject you because you're queer. And my kids actually think that it's because of the divorce that she stopped talking to me, that was untenable for her. But I think it's, you know, she was in her 90s, and I think it was a bit of both, honestly. And we just kept moving forward. We started talking to a mediation attorney and deciding what we were going to do. And I kept dating, you know, meeting people and going on dates. And I found one thing, I don't know if other people find this, but after having been friends with women my entire life, suddenly I'm going on dates. And I'm even going out with queer women I've known for a long time who are single, wondering, is this a date or are we just friends? And how do you know? And I just didn't know how to know that. So that was a bit confusing and perplexing. But at somewhere along the way, I met someone and we really clicked, and there was a lot of passion and also intellectual and spiritual connection. And it was really a kind of relationship I'd never had before. But it also got extremely challenging very, very quickly. There was a lot of intense emotion, a lot of conflict. And I just had never had that. And I started to not feel very safe, but I kept being drawn back to that relationship and that person, and ultimately ended up in a relationship with this person. And shortly after that, the pandemic started. And exactly what happened was I moved out of my house into my own apartment 6 days before the shelter in place started. Great timing. And I had all these plans, and Mark and I had all these plans that we were going to keep having family dinners, and I'd have everybody over to my place, and you know, I'd have one of my kids live with me and all this stuff. And initially I said I need some time by myself in my place. So I didn't want one of my kids to come live with me. 6 days later, the pandemic shelter in place started. And all of a sudden I was bubbling with, you know, my partner who I'd been with just for a few months, and couldn't see my kids, couldn't touch my kids, couldn't hug my kids. I was out of their life in a way I'd never been. I'd been homeschooling them. I was so, so present in their life. And also, in a way, it was like being taken for granted, because, you know, you just take your parents for granted when they're home. You don't really think about their life. I don't think they really noticed how much we did or didn't have conversations. We were just always around each other. And then suddenly I was out of it, and we were all going through the scariest time of our lives because of the pandemic, and I could not be there for them. And it was absolutely heartbreaking. And also for Mark, like I couldn't be there with him as we were splitting up our 30-year relationship. It was really, it was so incredibly hard. And the relationship I was in was really, really, really challenging for me. And because of the pandemic, I stayed much longer than I should have. And it ended up being about 2.5 years. So throughout that whole time of the pandemic, it was really, really complex. So many layers of leaving my marriage, leaving, selling our house we had actually built ourselves, not seeing my kids, not being able to see my family, my mom and everything. It was just thing after thing after thing. And this relationship was very, very hard. There were some beautiful things, and there were many, many hard things ultimately outweighing the good things. So during that time, I suddenly was supporting myself after 30 years of being in a partnership, and was terrified. I had to close my studio. I moved everything online, and also had a job writing curriculum. So luckily the curriculum really helped keep me afloat financially while I was building my business up to also being 50% of my income. And the amazing part, and I think one of the beauties of the pandemic for me, was that my business took off. So it grew in the area of like private coaching. So not just doing classes. I did have a class I ran right away called Creative Life Raft. And it was our journaling online, and we were all dealing with all of this angst and fear and all the stuff from the pandemic. It was sort of perfect for the work I already was doing. But I also started working with people one-on-one over Zoom, and it was amazingly helpful and easy to do, and people loved it. And so that grew. Yeah. So now I'm completely supporting myself through my own work. And that's so gratifying. So gratifying that I get to do that. And I'm proud of myself. And I'm out of that relationship, ended last summer. And that actually was probably the hardest thing I've ever done, was to get out of a toxic relationship. It was in some ways harder than getting out of my loving 30-year marriage, because I was not being supported to get out of it. It was a fight to the bitter end. And it took everything I had to move myself forward. I actually, about a year ago, I did some deep work envisioning the future. And I saw myself by myself. I saw myself not in that relationship, at least. So I just kept picturing myself in the future. Once I decided, okay, this is the future, you got to pay attention. This is the vision you're having for your future, and it's you living on your own terms, finally. because I didn't have that experience. When I moved out of my house, I was already in the relationship. So I never was alone. I never, you know, it didn't feel like being alone was going to be helpful because I need to be with somebody else to feel queer. Otherwise, it just felt like me. And that didn't feel like enough identifying with the queer part. So anyway, getting out of that relationship, I felt like I had lost myself, and then I had found myself, and then I saved myself.
Say that one more time. That was really cool.
And I should back up and say, first, I found myself, right? When I came out, I found my, like, whoa, here I am. Woo, who's that? Found myself, but then lost myself, gave up a big part of myself in that relationship. Then I found myself, and then I saved myself. And that was powerful. I look at the photographs of myself when I moved out, and it's like, that is the strongest woman I know right there. She just did something Herculean.
Powerful. And so the journey to get you to save yourself, Susie, is what you're talking about, what you help your other clients do.
Mm-hmm.
So you went through that art journaling process and discovered and...
Yeah, basically uncovering a truth that was so scary to look at. Again, I mean, I had already done it to come out, but this was another level of it. And once it was out on paper, I just could not deny that I had to pay attention to it. And during the year before that, actually, Mark and I had finalized our divorce. And, or actually, I guess it was during last year. So it was during the breakup, Mark and I finalized our divorce. I call him my husband more than I call him my ex-husband. What he says is, we had a good run, you know, we look back on it. And happy to say he's very happy in a new relationship. And I'm so happy for him. And we're very good friends and family. And we have been able to pick back up what we had always intended to have, which was to stay loving towards each other and support each other and be parents to our kids together and be friends. And we are very solidly in that place. And I give him a lot of credit for that. You know, he could have been super angry at me on many occasions. I don't think I behaved very well when I first came out. And even still, I felt like a teenager. Like the part of me that was queer, that was finally getting some time to explore herself, was like a 16-year-old. And 16-year-olds don't really always have the best manners. So I did some things that I'm not so proud of. But anyway, it's okay. I really understand who that was and why. I still feel like that. I still feel like a teenager in some ways inside this 60-year-old body. But getting out of this other relationship was a moment of really leaning into who am I and what do I need? And this is my life and this is my opportunity to live exactly what I need to live. And one of the things that happened was, as I was envisioning where I wanted to end up, I remembered a dream I'd had for decades of living in an artist's loft, like a live-work loft. And I am, beyond doing this transformational creativity work, I also paint. And I really wanted to, had an urge to paint really big paintings. And I want to have this artist space. And so I went in search of a loft, and I found one, and I moved into it in July, and it's amazing. It's the coolest place, and people come in and their jaws drop. They're like, this is so you. It's incredible. My art is everywhere, and a whole third of the space is for my art making and my work. And it just, there's this flow and the colors of my paintings all over the walls, and everything is just all right there in the space I live in. And I really feel like I manifested or fulfilled a dream for myself. That's a very important thing. It was never, ever before this moment, the right time for me to do it, ever. And so that also felt like you just have to sometimes wait for the moment to be right. And having a dream, you don't, just because it's not the right time for it to come true, doesn't mean you should give it up. It just might not be the right time for it. And honestly, saying that, I feel like, well, that's the same thing with coming out. Like when it was the right time, it was the right time. And that's why it happened.
If you were to give anyone advice or words of wisdom about your journey and how you can translate it to their journey. Like if a listener is listening to your story thinking, huh, what could you say to impact somebody?
I would say, don't let fear rule you. Don't let fear be the thing that holds you back from your truth. I look at my journals, it was so much about my fear. And even when I was going through it, there was a lot of fear. But for so long, the fear of what I was going to, how I was going to hurt everyone and do things to, you know, break their hearts and lose all the people. And I did lose people. Like I mentioned, my mother-in-law, I did lose people. I actually lost a lot of people, but the important people I did not lose. My children, I did not lose. Even my husband, I did not lose, and my whole family. And the fear held me back from taking steps towards my future. And so I really try to remember that. And that's what I would tell people. Don't let fear be the thing, because it's just a fear is a thought. It's not true. It's just a thought and a projection.
And yeah, like you say, and it stops you from getting where you need to be, mm-hmm. where you are supposed to be.
Right.
And so with that lead in, we're curious to find out where you are now as you smile. So Susie, where are you now in as far as being queer, being connected, being in relationship? We would like to know.
Well, I'm in a variety of queer communities. I think as much as I don't love Facebook, it's been really a lifeline for me to be in queer communities, and I have a lot of queer friends now. I recently met the person that I feel like I've been looking for my whole life, and she's amazing, and we're madly in love, and we're completely on the same page with that, with each other. And it's not just being in love, it's coming home. I feel like when we're together, even when we're apart now, I feel like I've come home. I found my home in a person, and I feel so calm and centered and happy and passionate. And it's like everything I thought I could have, but also was afraid to dream was possible. So it's an amazing experience.
We want to thank you so much for coming on to our show today, or this evening, actually. Your story is so inspirational and will be inspirational to many of our listeners for years to come, Susie, because this show will be archived and available to anyone who wants to listen at any time. And I feel like you've really given us a gift through sharing your story. And we want to thank you so very much for being on our show. Yeah. You are the ultimate living proof.
The living proof, ultimate. Yes, exactly. Like face the fear. Was that as a quote there? But I can't
face the fear and do it anyway.
Anyways. Yeah. And yeah. See what's there.
Do you have one last thought you'd like us to know before we leave?
Yeah, I think it's something I tell my students, and it's, you never know where the mess will take you. You always get to a place, it's like the messy middle or whatever. It's just like, just total mess. It's just not pretty, but you have to keep moving through it because you literally have no idea where it's going to get you in the end. And that's often an incredibly beautiful place. So keep moving forward.
We want to thank you so much. It's time to say goodbye. And we want everyone to remember that just like Susie, you too can be living proof that through being truthful about who you are, finding yourself along the way, and living your most full, authentic life, you can make this world a better world. This is Diana Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
good night.
And if you want to get hold of Susie Stonefield, you can reach her at unfoldart.com. That's UNFOLDART.com.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.